This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For many kids, the excitement of a new grade and different teachers is hard to beat as the school year gets underway. But reality can set in pretty quickly as backpacks start to fill up with textbooks and assignments. This hour, it's the homework debate. What are the benefits of after-school assignments, and what's the proper balance? At what point does the homework load become detrimental? And should very young children even have homework? Also, later this hour, we'll take a look at the history of the homework debate in this country, going on for well over a century, and we'll examine the digital divide. Increasingly, assignments are being given online, but many kids do not have good internet access at home, and so are missing out. We're opening up the phone a little bit earlier this hour. So on which side of the debate do you land? The number is 888-477-9499, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So now let's welcome Harris Cooper, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University and leading researcher on the issue of homework. Hello, Harris.
Hello.
So you've done extensive research on a number of studies regarding homework. Let's begin with kids at the elementary school level. What is the academic benefit of homework? What have you found?
Well, we've done studies of studies, something called the meta-analysis, where we go and we collect up all of the studies that have been done of a particular type, and then we combine their results statistically to come up with the strongest possible, most precise answers to questions. We can also look for things that influence how large the effect of homework is that way in many different ways than you can do in an individual study. When we do that, what we find is that there is a very small correlation at the youngest grades between how much homework kids say they do or their parents say they do and how well they're doing in school. When we get to middle school, that relationship becomes stronger and stronger still at high school. It's also the case, however, that there are studies in which kids have been given homework and no homework, where homework has been manipulated. And even in grades as early as the second grade, kids who study their spelling words, their math facts, and their vocabulary at home before taking a test at school, perhaps with the help of their parents, do better on those tests than kids who don't.
So overall, as far as younger kids is concerned, is homework of great benefit or minimal benefit? What have you found?
Homework can be of great benefit as long as it is age and developmental level appropriate. So young children should be getting small amounts of homework that are short, simple, lead to success, allow their parents to take part in the process so that the parent can gauge how well the child is doing, where their strengths and weaknesses are, and also express to the child how important homework is and school is. It also something that developmental psychologists speak of as scaffolding. It begins the process of learning how to study, and homework can be how to study, and also time management. If we wait until the middle schools to begin assigning homework, when kids are suddenly not caring so much about how much their parents think about them and care more about their friends, that's a bad time to start saying, now you have to do homework.
All right. Staying with the elementary level for just a moment or so more, I want to ask your opinion of this from the New York Times last week. A second grade teacher in Texas, name of Brandy Young, let parents know on Meet the Teacher night that she has no plans to load up her students' backpacks. She writes in a note that was posted on Facebook, "There will be no formally assigned homework this year. Rather, I ask that you spend your evenings doing things that are proven to correlate with student success. Eat dinner as a family, read together, play outside, and get your child to bed early." Is this a radical move, or are we seeing more of this in districts across the country?
That's a wonderful prescription, but I don't know why it means that a second grader shouldn't be bringing home 20 minutes of homework a night. What worries me is that that extra 20 minutes will be spent in front of a screen, not having dinner with your parents, not playing outside, not reading for enjoyment. Good homework assignments can use all three of those activities and build the homework into them. That's the best kind of homework, something that your parents help you with, something that you need to read for school, perhaps a choice you have that is of high interest reading to you, something you might read even if it wasn't homework, or, say, applying mathematics to your sports team. Any of those are a little harder on the teacher, makes them think a little bit, but it also incorporates the things that kids are doing in school into activities they enjoy doing at home. Especially for seventh graders, that kind of message is the best message we can send to kids.
Harris Cooper, let's talk about the perspective that many kids are being overloaded. There's a lot of stress. This is from NPR, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, asked students of all ages how much homework they had every day. And the answer from elementary to high school was less than an hour. Another study, this one from the National Center for Education Statistics, found that high school students who said they had homework did on average about 7 hours a week. How do you parse this?
Well, I think they're right. What we're talking about when we think about children who are bringing home too much homework, and there are children who bring home too much homework, they are a minority. So about, it's a several years old, but these numbers don't change a great deal. Dr. Gill will confirm this later. The MetLife Foundation did a national survey of teachers, parents, and children. And one of the questions they asked the parents was, how much homework does your child bring home each night? Too much, too little, and just the right amount. 60% said to just the right amount. 15% said too much, and 25% said too little. When you ask kids a similar question, do you do your homework every night? How much do you do? About 84% say they can finish their homework in an evening.
Yeah. How much of a driving force are parents in homework load?
Oh, I think that's why we're talking about this today. Yeah. There are instances in which kids are assigned too much homework. With a second grader, if your second grader is bringing home 2 hours of homework a night, that's too much. And in some instances, this is happening. Educators will tell you they're doing it because of the added scrutiny that they're getting when their end-of-grade test scores at the end of third grade are published in the paper. There's evaluations of them that can be based upon the number of students who pass the end of grade scores. Parents who are sitting right next to, whose child is sitting right next to the parent who's complaining about too much homework is another parent who's complaining about too little. And they're putting up with these pressures. One of their strategies for addressing the pressure is to add to the homework load. And it's not doing what it's supposed to.
What do you think of the 10-minute rule? Essentially, multiply the grade level by 10 and you come up with the number of minutes ideally spent in study after school?
I've spent 30 years applauding the 10-minute rule. We looked at homework charts of kids who were asked, how much homework do you do at night and what is your achievement? And what we found, even though it was much rougher than the 10-minute rule would suggest, is that when you get up to about 60 to 90 minutes of homework in middle school, you've reached asymptote, which means it's optimum. The same thing with 2 to 2.5 hours in high school and even less than that in elementary school. So the data fits the rule. Also, if you look at the internet, and I've tried to do this, I'm happy if somebody can find one that's different. And you look for homework policies quality and look what school districts recommend. They're almost always in line with the 10-minute rule. They won't say 10-minute rule. They'll say 10 to 30 minutes for the earliest grades. 30 to 60 for the upper primary grades, and so on.
Harris, no surprise here. We've got calls coming in already on the homework debate. So we're going to go to Mount Airy. And Mike, you're live on Radio Times. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was wondering how your guest feels about my experience. I had my child enroll in a private college prep school, 7th, 8th, and half a year, and I'll tell you why. He got 3 hours of homework every night through 7th and 8th grade. And basically, with the sports that they require, he was so exhausted, he could never get the sleep that he needed. And you could see it in his face. He had huge bags he could carry his books in.
And did you end up pulling him from the school because of that?
I pulled him in 9th grade. He only made it through half of the year because he basically broke down. He was getting no sleep, no rest, requirement to play in sports, sometimes getting home at 6 or 7. It's insanity what they're expecting.
And
I was wondering how your guest feels about, I mean, okay, it was my option to send them there.
Mike, you know what? We're approaching our first break. A quick follow-up. Are you finding your child has less stress as far as homework load in the public school system?
I actually sent him to a specialized school, also private.
Okay. Let me just get a quick comment from Harris before you hit the break.
A's, and he got straight A's.
So switching worked for you. Mike, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. And just quickly before we get to the break here, Harris Cooper, is there a huge difference in what you find in private schools versus public school education as far as homework load?
I'm not aware of any particular studies that have empirically looked at the difference. But based upon the conversations that I have with parents, yes, the college prep schools do require more homework, and they expect that when, as Mike pointed out, he embodies the dilemma. Okay, I can't solve the dilemma for him, but he embodies it. It's, I want my kid to get the most out of school, to achieve at their highest potential, and then the school says, we're going to push your kid until they drop over. And there are so many instances of this at that upper end. That something really ought to be done about it.
It sounds as if he's taken steps that have led to a happy ending. He switched his kid out.
The most important thing is that your child is happy and they find themselves gainfully and productively employed when they finish school. So if it means not going to that super prep school that promises you 98% of our students go on to elite institutions and it gets dialed back a little, but suddenly there's a smile on your child's well-rested face, It's worth it.
It's the Homework Debate on Radio Times. Harris Cooper, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, is here. And in just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Mathematica Policy Research's Brian Gill to talk about the history of the debate. We've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Stay with us as Radio Times continues. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. What are the benefits of homework and how much is too much? The debate has been going on for well over a century in this country. And for the next few minutes, we'll get a bit of a history lesson about homework. Harris Cooper is with us for a while longer on Radio Times. Harris, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University and leading researcher on the issue of homework. And we're also joined by Brian Gill, senior fellow at Mathematica Policy Research. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
And sure, just for a moment, and a bit of levity, we've got a clip from The Simpsons. Bart Simpson, always the rebel, is at school and eager to show off his anti-homework t-shirt.
Tonight's homework assignment is...
Oh, man, is it hot in here. I'd better take off my sweater.
Down with... homework? Don't look at it, children.
The shirt makes a good point.
I'm with the shirt. Homework rots.
Down with homework! Down with homework!
Bart and classmates doubtless capturing the mood of a lot of kids and parents as we head into the new school year. So Brian Gill, that's kind of a new twist on an old story. This debate has been going on for at least 100 years in the United States. Let's begin with the decades before World War II. There was a real progressive movement in play where homework was not looked upon kindly.
Yeah, that's right. There were a lot of progressive educators and parents who were not sympathetic to homework. Going back even to the turn of the 20th century, when in 1900, the Ladies' Home Journal described homework as a national crime at the feet of American parents. In 1925, you had a New York City principal calling homework a sin against childhood. And the concerns that people raised then, some of them were similar to the concerns you hear about now. Medical doctors were prominent in the debate against homework in the early 20th century, raising concerns about kids' spines being bent by carrying home heavy loads of books and kids being stressed out too much. You can flash forward to the 21st century and see those arguments coming up again in things like the Race to Nowhere documentary, mm-hmm. which basically argued that homework had led a kid to suicide. Now, these claims then and now are rarely based on much more than anecdote. They typically don't have a whole lot of grounding in the experiences of most American kids or in empirical data.
Yeah. Well, then what happened in the late 1950s? The Soviet Union launches Sputnik and the first satellite to orbit the Earth. And what next?
Yeah, the attitudes toward homework changed quite a bit. In fact, if you look at the data on how much time high school students in particular spend on homework, really the only time in the last 60 or 70 years when you can see a substantial increase for the average American student is in the decade after Sputnik, when you had in 1958, the National Defense Education Act was really about the first federal intervention in K-12 schooling in American history, and it was couched in national security terms. We had to catch up with the Russians, and we had to improve our schools, and the kids had to do more homework. That, at least in terms of time spent, that seems to have lasted about a decade, and then the most.
Then came the 60s and 70s.
Done before, yes, yes, and. The 80s and 90s were striking in that it was a rare period in which there seemed to be a sort of expert and popular consensus that homework was a good thing and more was better. But that consensus did not lead to substantial increases in homework for most kids. It did lead to a change for the youngest kids. Kids in the primary grades of elementary school started doing homework in the 80s and 90s and have continued that today, whereas before that, basically they hadn't done any. Now, on average, they typically do pretty modest amounts. There's really very little evidence, though, of a substantial increase for kids in middle school or high school. With the exception of that decade after Sputnik, if you look at the last 60 years of American history, it's been true nearly all of the time that most American high school students seem to be doing something less than 6 hours a week of homework. So as Professor Cooper mentioned, there are these cases, these extreme cases where kids are certainly being overburdened and doing too much, but now and in the past, those have been fairly rare exceptions.
Just back to the 60s and 70s for a moment, when there was relatively little homework, there were all these huge political and cultural changes, of course, during those decades. I remember that I had little to no homework, and I enjoyed school, and I enjoyed after-school activities. Harris Cooper, you want to weigh in?
Well, and let me say a few things about what Brian said. He can correct me if I'm wrong. The actual amount of homework that teachers report assigning over the last 6 or 7 decades really has not changed that much. What we're seeing when we see the pros and the cons, whether it's global competitiveness or too much stress on children is what the mass media picks up. It's the extreme end of the story. Recently, there has been a bit of an increase in the amount of homework that kids in the earliest grades do. And educators will tell you that it's largely because of our increased understanding of how important it is for 4, 5, 6, and 7-year-olds to be exposed to language and reading. If you can read by the third grade, it is a great marker for your potential success in school. If you can, it's the other way around. At the high school level, one of the things that seems to be happening is there's greater variability. So some kids are coming home with no homework at all at the 11th and 12th grade. They have after-school jobs. There's no support from the parents. Other kids are coming home with huge amounts of homework.
Harris, that can depend on the track the kid's on, right?
Correct, because they choose whether, am I college-bound or not college-bound? Am I elite college-bound or just college-bound? And as they do, the rigor of their course schedules will change.
Brian Gill, I'd like to get to perhaps a key to some of the stress many school children are experiencing. We've got a comment from somebody who'd like to remain anonymous. Parents worry about homework but are okay about long sports schedules, I should say. So kids perhaps are more scheduled than they have been over the last century.
You know, I suspect that is probably true. I don't know the data on that all that well. The first thing I should say, though, is that if you look at the opinion polls, and Harris mentioned this earlier, it's the case most parents support homework and think their kids are not getting too much. That's been true pretty much forever. So the concerns about homework are coming from a relatively small number of parents. But I think that there are good reasons to believe that to the extent that kids are having trouble fitting homework into their schedules, it may be because of the other competing demands they've got, sports being a key one. I mean, I've got a 13-year-old daughter. She has far less free time than I did when I was 13, but it's not because of homework. It's largely because of sports and everything else. There's so much competition now for kids' time that homework may be getting squeezed and pushed to the end of the day when kids need to be going to sleep.
Yeah. All right, we've got a number of calls on the call board here. So heading out to Vineland, Scott, you are on Radio Times. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, my question is, I'm wondering what happens to kids once they get to college if they have no homework when they're growing up, because generally homework not only teaches you the subject matter but also teaches you how to study. So I'm wondering, sort of what happens once they get to college.
Harris Cooper?
That's a really good question. Schools should teach how to study, and probably it should start in the third, fourth grade, but certainly by middle school. There are good ways to study. There are bad ways to study. When kids get to college, everything is turned on its head. They spend 3 hours a week in a class where they're getting formal instruction, and they can spend 4 to 9 hours a week having to study on their own. If they have never done that before, they are not prepared to do it in college.
Scott, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Worth noting, a survey in the Journal of Experiential Education a couple of years back found students from 10 high-achieving high schools said they brought home an average of just over 3 hours of homework a night, but over 90% of these kids went on to college. Is there a connection here, Harris?
Well, I think so, but the first connection is they're bright kids to begin with. So saying there's a cause, their whole ability to get into colleges and good schools is not only because they did their homework. It's because they were damn bright kids to begin with. And 3 hours of homework, if it was really 3 hours, is not a great amount. They probably would have done just as well with a little bit less. If you added much more than that, it probably would have gotten in the way of their learning.
All right, let's get to an email from Joan, who says, I can attest to the harm of even a little homework in grade school, specifically second grade. My son's second grade teacher gave the most boring and repetitive homework based on a spelling word list that I sometimes wanted to rebel. And in single-parent families or families in which both parents work, we felt we had no quality time with our children when we got home. Brian Gill, was quality time, I don't know if your research covered this, but was quality time an issue in the earlier decades preceding this one?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, homework is controversial now and in the past, partly because it comes really right at the intersection of parent and school authority. So it's always been the case that parents who are opposed to homework or want to have less of it may have other plans for their children's time. And so there's an inherent tension there. On the other hand, though, parents, as I mentioned earlier, most parents have supported homework. And in part, they support it because it gives them an essential window onto the school's program for their kids. Now, you know, in some cases, that window suggests that what the school cares about is just rote learning, and that's unfortunate. But there, the problem is not homework per se. The problem is the quality of the homework. Historically, some of the people opposed to homework, some of the experts opposed to homework, were opposed to it because they didn't trust parents and they wanted to keep them out of the educational process. So there are a lot of complicated issues going on there.
Harris Cooper, when is a parent too involved in helping, in quotations, with homework?
Well, you know, you mentioned The Simpsons, and there's another Simpsons episode where Homer is outraged because he only received a C+ on Bart's assignment. So obviously, if teachers ask you to take part in something like a spelling test, while it may be boring, it's actually perfect. It's a perfect place. You learn spelling through rote. I don't want my kid spending lots of time in classroom with an educator doing things by rote. So bring them home. We all did the Thursday night pretest of spelling words for the Friday test. And yes, the kids who bring home homework and do it with their parents do better on those exams. It's also the obligation of the teacher to mix it up. So it shouldn't always be rote. It shouldn't always be practice. There should be parts of it that are fun things for kids and parents to do together.
But tempting as it is, if you find yourself doing too much of the project as a parent, that's not going to help your kid.
Too much of a project, yes. Do it if the teacher asks you, and if the teacher doesn't, stay away. If your kid asks for help, give guidance. Don't give answers.
What about the concept of introducing new material in homework? Brian Gill, what do you think about that?
So that's not one that the historical record has a whole lot to say about. Yeah. But I think, you know, as Harris suggested, there's probably considerable value in varying homework. And if it's new material that is, you know, that is going to get the students engaged, then great.
Harris?
Yes, engagement is critical. New material is a little bit hard. It's sometimes called an advanced organizer, where you ask kids, and it's not necessarily graded homework, how does this apply to this? How do you integrate these different skills to do something? Those are great things to do with homework, but you have to be careful with it because kids can get frustrated, and some things they really need guidance with. If it's something they can do on their own and it brings skills together or introduces a new skill that you will then cover in class, that's great.
We've got a message from Richard, who asks, are we starting the trend of Americans not taking their vacation time and becoming workaholics by making children have 6 to 7 hours of school, pushing extracurricular activities as a mandatory requirement for college on top of 2 or more hours of homework? Brian, is there a trend here?
Well, again, there's very little evidence that homework is a major problem there, if there's a trend. Maybe there's a trend in having kids being scheduled more of their time, but there's just no evidence that there's been some enormous increase in homework time for high school kids, or that large numbers of them are spending a ton of time on this. Again, for most high school students, it's something less than 6 hours a week.
Harris Cooper, how does the U.S. compare with other countries in homework, the amount of homework?
It varies dramatically. The countries vary in both their homework assigned and how many days and how long the school day is, whether kids go to school on Saturday. The cross-cultural comparisons are really very important, but not to show that this is a better way. Instead, to look for innovations that might or might not work in our culture. We don't simply adopt the Finland model because they're higher on math scores internationally than we are. Instead, we look at how they teach, we look at when they teach, and we look at who they teach, and we say, can this work here better than what we're doing now? And that's a great way to use what's happening in other countries.
And as we wrap up this segment, Harris, any final thoughts on for parents as they prepare to send their kids off to the new year?
Support your school. If you have concerns with what's happening in your child's class, talk with the teacher and talk with the teacher privately. You and your kids' teachers are a team. If you convey that to your teacher, your kid will have a good year, and it won't be mom against dad, grandparents against parents, all those tricks kids learn
sure.
to get what they want.
I gotta stop you there. Harris Cooper, thanks so much for joining us, and Brian Gill, our thanks to you as well.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up next, the digital divide. Keep it here. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Often as not, today's school children will find homework assignments online. But according to the Pew Foundation, 5 million households, families in this country, do not have access to high-speed internet. And this has led to what FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel calls the homework gap. Jessica, good to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So tell us more about the homework gap and what is the fallout?
Sure. Well, you know, when I was in school, I might be dating myself, but all I needed was paper, pencil, and my brother leaving me alone for me to do my homework.
Right there,
you know,
with you.
Right. That last one was the hardest part, but paper and pencil were largely sufficient. And today, that's no longer true. Basic schoolwork now often requires internet access. And the data suggests now we have 7 in 10 teachers assigning homework that requires internet access. But the data from the Federal Communications Commission, where I work, shows that only 1 in 3 households does not have that access.
That is a big gap.
So, right. So where those numbers overlap is what I call the homework gap. And that is a new digital divide. And it's one we need to solve for the success of our students and for the sake of our economy going forward, which is a digital one.
So let's get into how students typically use the internet for homework. What do they need to search? What are they looking for?
Well, I'm certainly not a teacher, but I've spent a lot of time with schools and students and administrators talking about how they use the internet and why broadband is so necessary. And it's clear to me that many of the tools I use to research, like a big, bulky card catalog or a microfiche machine, those are not the ways that research takes place today. And it's no longer necessary to go pull a big, bulky volume of the encyclopedia off the shelf to try to understand a concept. We have information of varying quality available to us all the time online, and it's just natural that we're incorporating that into education and research in school.
Well, not only are kids Googling things. They're also connecting mm-hmm. with teachers. There are, Absolutely. You know, there are group discussion boards. There are shared documents. So,
I mean, there's so many more ways to be educated right now than strictly having a classroom with desks and a teacher who lectures. And I've spoken now with teachers who describe how they set up online fora and how students who are not accustomed to raising their hand in class will participate in those online fora. And it fosters confidence in their work, and it creates a new dynamic in their classroom when they do get together. And there's things like flipped classrooms, which you might have heard of, because there are more teachers now who develop their lessons and they set up perhaps a 15-minute lecture, assign the students to watch and watch it again at home, and then come into the classroom and do homework together in the classroom.
So that is a flipped classroom?
That's a flipped classroom. And all of these things require a level of connectivity in the school, but also in the home. And so this is a digital divide we have to address.
So 1 in 3 school children in this country do not have that level of connectivity.
No, 1 in 3 households.
Households, I'm sorry.
And it's important to recognize that not all those households will have school-aged children. You mentioned at the start some Pew data that says about 5 million households with school-aged children don't have connectivity today. And that's probably the best number we have out of 29 million households with school-aged children in the country.
So, Jessica Rosenworcel, so trying to get to the school library or the public library isn't enough for these children?
Well, certainly that's part of the solution. But we don't have libraries that are accessible to every student in every place. And I've certainly spoken to school administrators who describe what it's like to have their students sit outside in the library parking lots at night just to get Wi-Fi access. And we have students who have library systems that are far from where they live, and they're not able to access them or get a parent to bring them there. And we've also got libraries that are crowded, where there's a queue to use the computers, particularly for students that may not have devices that allow them simply to access a wireless signal. So libraries are absolutely part of the solution. And there's some creative things happening in our libraries, including the loaning out of wireless hotspots that can help with the homework gap. But I believe the solution has to be broader than just our libraries.
I was in doing research for this show. I was reading that young people will actually go to fast food restaurants to access Wi-Fi for homework, or sit outside the restaurants if they can't get a table.
Right.
And they're
Ahead. I know. I've met with students who've described to me how they sit at the table of a fast food restaurant with some fries and a fizzy drink that they nurse all night while they write their papers. And when they close it, I've spoken to one student. He says, well, you know, if I stand up outside the bricks of the fast food restaurant at night, I can still access the signal, so I finish my work outside in the parking lot.
So standing up outside the bricks at night, are they getting their homework done and getting it done well? What are you hearing?
Well, there's certainly, I would tell you, an extraordinary tenacity in students that are going to those, you know, making those efforts. So let's credit them. And there's data to suggest that the students who are suffering from this homework gap are really resourceful. About a third of them go to school early or stay late to use their school's internet. About a quarter of them are trying to use libraries. And about a fifth of them are going to fast food restaurants or cafes. But that's hard for your nightly homework, and no parent would wish that for their child. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to come up with more programs to get more students connected at home, because it'll make homework easier to do in the digital age.
So, again, you are an FCC commissioner. Tell us about the Lifeline program.
Sure.
How many people are covered by this? What does it do to include families so that they have access to broadband?
Sure. Well, since 1985... the FCC has had a program called Lifeline. And maybe you remember 1985, but it's when most communications involved a cord. President Ronald Reagan was in the White House. It was a long time ago. But the program that we started back then, my predecessors did, was all about saying, hey, for you to have a fair shot at monitoring your child's education, keeping a job, managing health care, our households all need to have phone access. So the Lifeline program supported households in all 50 states that were low income and without it would not have had access to basic phone service.
Tell
but
us
today. Let's be clear. Dial tone in the digital age involves broadband. So the FCC updated that program, and in the next year or so, that same support will be eligible for broadband, which we hope will encourage more low-income households to get online.
So will this cover most students in this country who currently do not have high-speed access?
You know, I think what's really important, we've made some very modest adjustments to this program. We're going to have to study its rollout and see what impact it has, and if it moves the needle in terms of getting more households that don't have service online, and in particular, households with students. At the same time, I don't think we can rely exclusively on this program. We're going to need a lot of other creative ideas. You know, we need to find ways to make sure we have more Wi-Fi in more places, because that's a huge democratizing force for internet access. And we're going to need to work with the companies that provide internet access today. Many of them have low-cost programs. And what we have to do is make sure that more students and their parents know about them.
Are providers embracing Lifeline customers?
Well, we're not at the point where we've actually put these changes to Lifeline fully in place. It's still moving through the paperwork associated with these changes in Washington.
You said over the next year, correct?
Yes, so over the next year, I would expect it to go into place. And then we're going to have to monitor it and see if we can fine-tune it to make sure it's as effective as possible at closing this divide and fixing this gap.
Are you getting early reaction from providers to the program?
Some interest, some enthusiasm. Many of them are now starting their own programs to try to encourage an increase in signing up for broadband access, particularly in low-income households, and there's a focus on low-income households with students. So I think that this is a place where a lot of public and private sector activity together are going to be able to solve this problem. But we're going to have to keep attention and focus on it, because so many people don't understand that what was viable for homework a decade or two ago is no longer what's needed today. And students graduating today need 21st century digital skills.
Yeah.
And making sure that they have broadband access at home and can do their homework is definitely part of that.
So, Jessica Rosen-Russell, there were some issues with fraud and waste with Lifeline over the years. Get into that, if you would, and tell us how the program is moving forward to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, listen, if we have anyone who is engaging or waste, fraud, or abuse of this system, we have to find it where it is and make sure it's stopped, and those who perpetuate it need to be punished. To be clear, we cannot accept any kind of waste or fraud in this program. And to the extent we've had any problems in the past, we've had enforcement actions, and going forward now, we've revamped our system to make sure that verification of households who apply is done by a third party and that there's no conflict of interest in identifying who can participate, which had been a problem in the past. So we're going to have to keep an eye on this program and make sure that it is well run, because it's important. And we have to make sure that programs like this are run with the care that the issue demands.
What sort of information does an applicant need to provide, and is it sensitive information?
Well, a lot of it is about participation and other existing federal programs that are offered to low-income households. And in the past, the assessment of that information was done by the provider or carrier themselves. And what we're doing now is we're making sure a third party is going to be doing that independently, that doesn't have an investment in signing up that individual. And we think that's going to be significant in helping prevent problems in the future. And we're certainly going to monitor to make sure that that's true.
So, Jessica Rosen-Russell, if somebody's listening to this program and says, wow, I really need to get my student on board with this, what are the first steps that they take in order to qualify for the discount?
Well, it's a function of participating in low-income household programs. And then also it's really important that they check with their existing internet service provider in their areas. Many of them have programs that will help them get service as low as $9.95 a month. And if you think about it, having that access, it can be the difference between your student keeping up in class and falling behind. and other things to do, find out where there are local Wi-Fi hotspots. There may be some in your neighborhood. I found communities across this country in Nevada, in Georgia, and Washington State that have come together and said, hey, it looks like we have too many of our students don't have access online. So if they can't do their homework at home and they need that access, any business or store that has free Wi-Fi, just put this little decal in your window so students will know it's a safe place for homework.
So the FCC is doing outreach then to contact
you? Absolutely. We're doing outreach. We're keeping tabs on schools and trying to understand the scope of this problem, but also make sure that our federal authority is a complement to local solutions, making sure that when communities come together and try to solve it, like with those decals or when they put Wi-Fi on school buses, that is the kind of activity that federal policies support, because education has always been local in this country. We prize that. We need to make sure that our federal policies support that kind of problem solving.
Are you talking to parents at all who are involved in the Lifeline program, and are you hearing back from them about how this might have helped their students move forward?
You know, I spent some time earlier this year in rural New Mexico and talked to a group of parents. And what struck me is that these four parents really trying to figure out how to make it work for their students. Some of them had no access at home, and they would spend an enormous amount of time driving their students to a family member who had a house maybe half an hour away to make sure that they could get the access they needed. They were parents who described waiting for their children late at night in a school parking lot, because that was the only place they knew that there was safe access from the wireless system. And there were parents who described having only a mobile phone plan with a limited data cap, and the efforts they went to reserve part of that subscription so that their students could at least look up math homework and do a little bit of research for their English classes.
I was going to say, just worth noting, too, in talking about places that young people can go to access Wi-Fi,
right,
the Coachella Valley District in California,
yeah, I've spent time
offering
there.
School buses with Wi-Fi routers so students can do homeworks as they head home from school or to school. And then the buses are parked in public,
yeah,
spaces where students can study. These
terrific,
isolated?
Yeah.
I mean, again, you're talking,
yeah,
about community involvement. Are these, right, isolated stories or?
No, you know what's happening is that we have this great reserve of ingenuity in this country and our communities. And Dr. Adams, who's the superintendent of Coachella Valley, looked around, saw all of these students who were hanging around school after hours because they had no access at home. And he said, you know, I got to come up with something to do for them. And in a rural area where students often spend an hour coming into school on a bus every day and an hour going back at night, he made those buses into connected buses by putting a Wi-Fi router on them. And so suddenly ride time is turned into connected time for homework. And when you look at what he's done, you realize they've started to copy it in other areas of the country. So when our good ideas emerge locally, we got to find ways for others to copy them and work with them too.
Ideally, though, we only have about 10 seconds left. It's best to be able to have access at home because you can have a quiet spot, a desk, and hopefully no interruption from a noisy sibling, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. That about wraps up the hour. Jessica Rosenworcel, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Jessica is an FCC commissioner. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for tuning in.